Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Sustainable Finance Podcast. My name is Paul Ellis, and I'm your host for these programs about developments in this fast-growing industry. Holly Turner is a climate specialist at Schroders Capital Private Assets, which manages $97 billion of assets under management in private capital markets around the world, across real estate, infrastructure, private equity, and private debt, as well as credit alternatives. Over the past few years, many managers and owners have made decarbonization commitments for a number of reasons in their portfolios, ranging from risk management to opportunistic investments or corporate direction of sustainability. In today's episode of the Sustainable Finance Podcast, we're speaking with Holly Turner. And to learn more about how her team evaluates the four levers for decarbonization that consider both the portfolio and real-world outcomes an investment can achieve, and which private market asset class is most likely to achieve each outcome, as well as contribute to a company's net zero commitment. Hello, Holly, and welcome to the Sustainable Finance Podcast.
Hi.
Nice to see you this morning. We're very excited to discuss this topic with you. And we're going to begin by asking you to tell our followers what the difference is between a portfolio decarbonization outcome and a real-world decarbonization outcome.
Sure. So a portfolio decarbonization focuses on initiatives that drive a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions in the context of a climate portfolio metric. So if we're talking about sort of climate or carbon portfolio metrics, they allow an understanding of both the carbon emissions or carbon exposure of an investment portfolio and also the ownership of these emissions, which the industry has termed financed emissions. So there are numerous carbon metrics available that have been sort of industry agreed across different disclosure practices and regulation. And each of these can be used in setting these portfolio decarbonization objectives. And each of them will have sort of varying pros and cons associated with them. And one thing, I guess, in the context of private markets is that some of these carbon metrics aren't transferable across asset classes. So they're very much limited in which asset classes they can be reported for. Portfolio decarbonization objectives can generally be achieved through the likes of active ownership with portfolio holdings, stock selection, diverting or reallocating cash flows, or where assets are directly managed, the creation of decarbonization sort of management plans for specific assets, for example. So for some of these, you're achieving both portfolio decarbonization and real-world decarbonization. So then moving to real-world decarbonization, these are initiatives or investments that drive economy-wide emissions reductions, largely through the avoidance or removal of emissions. For an example of this would be directly held assets decarbonizing due to a switching of electricity to low carbon. The asset will report a lower carbon emissions figure, notably in what is known as scope 2 emissions. And this would achieve not only a decarbonization of portfolio emissions, but also a real world decarbonization.
Okay. Well, listen, I've mentioned in the opening remarks that many managers and owners have made decarbonization commitments. Can you provide an overview of these as we move through the discussion today?
So yeah, I agree. In the past couple of years, we've seen both managers and owners setting all different types of decarbonization commitments. And it's probably worth mentioning that, you know, many of those will set multiple targets across different timelines. So for example, you could have a longer term sort of net zero commitment. And then you might follow that up with more interim objectives. So the ones on the slide here are focusing very much on the four types of interim objectives that we see happening in the market. And each of these would be measured by a different metric or outcome. So the first of these is an emissions reduction objective. So it's largely what we sort of discussed previously on portfolio decarbonization and starts by selecting a portfolio carbon metric and setting an emissions reduction sort of commitment on that metric. This could be an annual reduction that you set, or it could be a future year in time. In the context of private markets, higher levels of liquidity within public markets enable changes to stock selection that would then help to lower portfolio emissions. Whereas when we're considering this for private markets, with much more illiquid portfolios, we might consider to have more limited influence. And so this type of commitment could carry a higher level of uncertainty in terms of specifically meeting the emissions reduction objective set. The second of these is a portfolio alignment goal. And these, I would say, are much more sort of more recent commitments that we see coming through, but are increasingly popular. And these are where you are examining the investment's alignment to 1.5 degrees or net zero, for example. And then your commitment is to increase the proportion of investments that are aligned over time. The strength of this type of goal is that it's transferable across asset classes, as a manager could develop a definition and framework for alignment across different asset classes. The third is also an increasingly popular type of target measure, and it's generally considered an allocation commitment. So a lot of the time we see this around climate or green solutions is the term used, but it's a committed investment amount towards a specific theme. It's generally considered for investments that help to enable the transition to low carbon, termed, you know, climate mitigation, or this could even include climate adaptation as well. The allocation commitment can work across asset classes, although dependent on what area or theme you're focusing on, it could very much tie the performance to a specific theme or investable universe. And then the last one is an engagement commitment. So this could be across a whole portfolio, or you could be targeting specific high impact sectors, and your commitment is to engage with a certain proportion of your investment holdings on the topic of, say, decarbonization or transition over time.
Okay. Now, are there unique characteristics to consider for private markets in relation to decarbonization? So, for example, taking into account asset class, sector, region, and asset-specific limitations, which might relate to climate data or have the potential for active decarbonization, can you set realistic decarbonization goals and apply relevant and effective interim targets to these kinds of metrics on an ongoing basis?
So we focused on, the first thing is to look at sort of levers of decarbonization that are available. So we focused on different portfolio carbon metrics, and this is really then sort of four levers of decarbonization that we consider. So they sit across carbon avoidance, carbon removal, and then the top two, so emissions-based reduction or alignment. And you can see there that they are tailoring slightly to either focus on, that allocation to climate solutions, so driving and investing in climate-related opportunities, versus the top two, which are more of a focus, we would say, potentially on the portfolio decarbonization type commitments we spoke to. And what we find is that each of these four sort of levers of decarbonization potentially naturally fit into some asset classes more than others. So if we take carbon avoided, for example, and carbon avoided would be emissions that are avoided using a specific product or service that replace an existing higher emitting version that's currently in the economy. So green infrastructure, notably renewables, would be an example of this, as well as things like climate innovation, climate tech, which you might be exposed to through private equity and debt that disrupt the market and replace incumbent processes with a lower carbon alternative. Carbon removal, a technology or natural asset that enables the capture or removal of carbon dioxide emissions from the atmosphere. Again, natural capital investments are more of an obvious choice for nature-based carbon removal, with infrastructure and private equity, mostly venture, for technologies that are innovating to directly remove carbon from the atmosphere. Whereas the top two, carbon reduction and alignment, we've sort of already touched upon when we're talking about portfolio and real-world decarbonization. But I'd say the focus would very much be, you know, real assets, particularly where an investment can carry a level of management over the asset that allows for targeted transitional decarbonization of the asset over time. The same could be said for direct private equity investments, again, where you have more of that sort of ability to influence and sort of govern and reduce those emissions over time. So I guess the exciting part when we're thinking about private assets really is the wide variety of different decarbonization options available across private markets, and really the sort of numerous different levers that you can look to pull for decarbonization. But I'd say the nature of private markets brings some challenges as well, around sourcing and tracking data to start with in some asset classes. We've had historically more limited regulation to support disclosure compared to public markets. And so in the first instance, engaging with managers and companies to really get access to the data and understand, you know, where is that investment sitting today from its carbon profile is really important. If we think about, you know, a manager that might hold really large real estate portfolios, for example, they would require data on both landlord and tenant related data across every asset. And so that internal data infrastructure and data management also becomes really important. And it's something we've spent a significant amount of time trying to get right. And then when you think about looking at decarbonization, you're also wanting to understand the evolution of an asset over time, meaning you might not want to just understand the carbon exposure today, but also have a historical view, which would require, you know, even more sophisticated data management. And another complexity when it comes to private markets, many data providers for public markets exist where you could download sort of historic data for companies relating back again to legacy regulation and disclosures that have supported this. In private markets, if the manager itself has not, you know, historically collected these data points, they may be more limited on that backwards looking component. And so then trying to understand how and where to set emission reduction targets or commitments could become more limited from the choice that you can make. So if we take that to implementing sort of a decarbonization strategy or commitment of some kind, the two key pieces that we think about are understanding the ability to decarbonize of an investment and understanding the type of influence as an investor we have. So because private markets has those distinct characteristics compared to public around, you know, namely longer term investment horizons, illiquidity that limit ability for early exit, in the context of decarbonisation, we're placing greater emphasis on that pre-investment stage assessment and due diligence. And that's where we really need those sort of decarbonisation methodologies to support that pre-investment due diligence stage. So these are the sort of four different types of methodologies that we think about when we're looking at the choices for a decarbonisation assessment. They go sort of almost in order of complexity, I would say. So the first you have is a binary target assessment. This is really just understanding the proportion of a portfolio with a type of climate commitment. So for example, what's the percentage of a portfolio that has a commitment to net zero or a science-based target commitment? And it's been favored to date as a method with the likes of, say, private equity, where a general partner with a high level of influence can encourage underlying investments to set certain commitments. And so over time, the percentage of the portfolio with that type of commitment would naturally increase. It's also a bit more of a simplistic metric, so it allows for a more simple due diligence and data capture process. So a lot of the time, maybe it could be the sort of starting point assessment that you might look at to implement for decarbonisation. The second is the maturity scale approach. This is more of a classification system that categorizes investments by their level of alignment. It can be built specific to an asset class, but if the same classification categories are used, it also enables sort of multiple asset classes to be combined. And we think this is quite a strong point to this assessment in the sense of where you, in private markets, you have such a difference between the asset classes. The ability to combine multiple together has a real sort of strong positive for this type of assessment. And we think that's why we've seen, you know, a lot more industry initiative development, publishing of recommendations and proposed frameworks around this type of decarbonisation assessment in recent years. The third is a benchmark divergence. So this uses a decarbonisation pathway that sets an expected emissions figure based on a climate scenario. And an investment is then compared to the pathway in the sense of, is it on its correct climate, you know, decarb pathway for 1.5 degrees? And where it is diverging from that pathway is the measure of decarbonisation or alignment, I guess you could say. And so it's the divergence from the pathway that's expressed as the metric. The best example within private markets of this would be within real estate, where there's a very commonly used methodology undertaken by the Carbon Risk Real Estate Monitor that would show an asset's divergence from its sort of 1.5 degree aligned asset pathway. The sort of downside with this one at the moment, I would say, is that decarbonisation pathway analysis relies on, you know, a high level of understanding around that pathway and the availability of these kind of clear decarbonisation pathways across sectors, countries and different activities. And at present, we find limitations on the availability of pathways for us to cover all types of investments within our private markets practice. Namely, you know, for a couple of examples would be within core infrastructure investments, where we struggle to find these clear pathways for decarbonisation across aspects like more assets like ports, roads, bridges, etc. And then the last one is really a temperature score. It basically takes the previous category around benchmark divergence one step further, and rather than reporting a percentage divergence, it converts that into a level of associated temperature rising or temperature score. There's a few different methodologies in the market that cover that. So that's really how we start with that sort of ability to decarbonize, is to take that methodology component. And then you need to overlay with general ability to decarbonize understanding around, you know, different sectors, different regions, and how quickly they are able to decarbonize. The second component for implementing a decarbonisation strategy, and I guess specifically for private market considerations, relates to our understanding on the type of influence that we have. So across private markets, different asset classes would hold different methods of influence. So types of influence could include, you know, active ownership, direct ownership and management of investments, use of proceeds and provision of capital, and then impact-related investments towards targeted themes. So with longer term horizons, and particularly sort of buy and hold strategies in private debt and equity, that pre-investment stage is really important, as I've previously said. And within certain strategies, criteria could even be incorporated within deal documentation. We could have intent or reporting requirements, or even binding criteria. So we've started to see examples, you know, within sustainability linked loans, where there is a committed rate of decarbonisation or a transition from certain revenue sources committed, which we could, you know, you can build in as a sort of area to influence and have a greater, I guess, guarantee or committed decarbonisation. And then within certain private asset investment strategies, there'll be even greater influence to operate and enhance assets directly. So that would enable managers to build operational and financial value from origination to exit. And this would largely be in the case of sort of direct real assets, where your ability to influence becomes both direct management of the asset, whilst also engaging with a wider set of stakeholders, suppliers, tenants as well on the topic. Same could be said for areas such as, you know, direct private equity, where a board seat at the company can enable a greater level of influence compared with private equity primaries, as an example, where then your engagement would be limited with, say, a general partner. So I guess, you know, that ability to influence decarbonisation is then one of those components that we consider in terms of how we set wider decarbonisation objectives or commitments for portfolios.
Okay, so one thing that we haven't discussed yet, Holly, is how these various measurement systems that Schroders Capital uses can apply across the different scopes. So scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions. As we know, scope 1 and 2 are normally in-house measurements, but scope 3 is probably an area that is more challenging for this type of decarbonization measurement, regardless of the industry or the sector. Am I right about that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think scope 3 continues to be more complex, and especially when we're linking that back to almost the ability to decarbonize, you know, I think we can have a pretty good understanding of a company's sort of scope 1 and 2 emissions profile and whether it's able to decarbonize those, particularly scope 2. We're really looking there at, you know, the simplistically the grid options and the power mix within the grid. And so that's where that country overlay around ability to decarbonize is particularly important. When you move that assessment into the sort of scope 3 framework, you know, you've got very complicated supply chains and potentially less of an understanding around what countries the company is exposed to, and also a lower level of, you know, ability to influence. So I would say the complexities become much greater. I would say also, you know, we still don't have a very clear sort of level of reported scope 3 emissions numbers. So very much still reliant a lot of the time on estimated scope 3 emissions numbers as well, which then of course will blur the actual sort of underlying activity or country exposure that those companies or assets might have in their supply chains.
Okay, so a lot of things to consider. And where to next? What are you currently developing in relation to decarbonization assessment at Schroders Capital that our followers would like to know about?
Sure. So the slide that's on the screen here is really our sort of three-step private assets decarbonization framework that we're really trying to build sort of across the multiple different asset classes or asset pillars that we have at Schroders Capital. And so we've been focusing really on developing this across 2024 and will continue to focus into 2025. So the left-hand side, the climate alignment, harks back to that sort of maturity scale assessment or methodology that I was referring to earlier. It was really our focus across 2024. Benefit of the metric, as I said, it's developed across asset classes. So we've developed it across multiple of our asset classes, specific framework per asset class, very much tailored to the asset class in question. So, you know, within infrastructure, we're looking at differences between greenfield and brownfield projects, questions around if it's a climate solution or, you know, a pure play renewable, does it get a different treatment than other types of infrastructure assets? So it's very much built for the asset class, but what it allows is the same reporting output for all asset classes, which means then when we're looking at reporting from a multi-private asset perspective, we can start to report across multiple asset classes together. On the right-hand side is one that we spent, you know, some time on in 2024, but hoping to sort of really finalize in 2025. And that's the development of a climate solutions identification tool. It helps us to look and identify activities linked to climate solutions, both climate mitigation and also increasingly on climate adaptation as well. It cross compares industry taxonomies and definitions to understand the agreement in the market on whether an activity is considered a climate solution, and also attempts to sort of contextualize the activity in terms of market context. What's the current deployment? What's the technology development stage? What's the investment capital required for us to really start to understand what the impact of that investment could be from a sort of market development or sophistication? And then the final component, which is the one right in the middle, is what's planned for development this year. So I guess throughout my responses on today's podcast has been around the importance on understanding the ability of an investment to decarbonize. And we want to understand that further from a sort of business activity sector, supply chain and location exposure. And so the idea is for us to build a methodology which we can look and understand where an investment is today and where do they have options to decarbonize, and where are they currently limited on their decarbonization ability? Is that because, you know, if we link back to the emissions, the scope 2 emissions, they operate in countries with very limited renewable energy on the grid and very limited options to sort of purchase that. So they are limited in how they can lower their scope 2 emissions, largely just through energy use rather than through sort of energy source switching. And that's the type of assessment we want to be able to overlay on our investments to understand, you know, where we can engage with them on decarbonization and where we understand that currently today, based on their environment, they are limited. I just wanted to highlight one of our examples on what we've been doing around the alignment framework across 2024 and one of the real benefits of doing so from that cross asset class perspective. So this is really showing that we've developed it for our private equity business and we've developed it for both co-investments and for primaries. So obviously in turn, meaning we're running an alignment assessment that can flex to both assess companies and their commitments for climate, as well as GP fund assessments and their alignment commitments. So the sort of process for assessment is different, but the alignment output, which is those six boxes at the bottom of the page, are the same across both. So that's really where I'm trying to highlight to you that, I guess, ability to run a decarbonisation assessment that's specific to a type of financing, but with the ability to combine the asset classes or the approaches together into one set of output metrics.
Okay, so what's happening clearly in the private markets is that Schroders and other companies are developing much more sophisticated assessment processes for decarbonization and other metrics that will be that need to be tracked, right? Because that's what investors are looking for. They want all the information so that they're able to report it effectively from within their portfolio and to their investors. Now, Holly, thanks so much for your time today. Tell us where online our followers for the Sustainable Finance Podcast can go to find out more about Schroders' guide to decarbonization in the private markets, and how can they get in touch with you with questions about the topics that we've discussed in today's program.
Sure. So I guess, yeah, if you've enjoyed listening to my ramblings and want to find out more, you can find the two private markets decarbonization guides on the Schroders Capital website, within the sustainability and impact channel. And I'd also suggest, you know, delving into the Schroders main website page also, where you'll find a sort of extended set of decarbonisation guides and narratives that we've written. And if you'd like to speak to me more personally, you can contact me at holly.turner@schroders.com.
Great. Holly, we'll also be glad to attach any documents or reports that you want to forward to us, and we can link to this episode as well. I want to thank you very much for your time today, Holly Turner of Schroders Capital, and we want to thank our followers for joining us for this episode of the Sustainable Finance Podcast. We'll be back again next week. My name is Paul Ellis.